We begin this hour, though, with Dr. David Kessler, the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, who is renowned for his efforts against the tobacco industry in the 1990s. He is out with a new book called The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. And it seems like a terrific time to talk to you, Dr. Kessler, because of the debate that we're going through with healthcare reform on Capitol Hill. So I welcome you to the program. Thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure being with you, Francis.
Talk first about the book. As I mentioned, it's called The End of Overeating. And I have to be honest with you, after reading through it, I didn't want to go out to dinner for quite a while. I wanted to do everything at home.
Well, you know, the reason I wrote the book was that I wanted to understand why it's so hard for millions of Americans to control their weight. That was the real question. One night I was watching Oprah. And on the show was a woman, very well-educated, very well-dressed, very sophisticated. And I was struck by what she was saying. She said that, you know, I was listening. She ate when her husband left for work in the morning. She ate before he came home at night. She ate when she was happy. She ate when she's sad. She says, I eat when I'm hungry. I eat when I'm not hungry. And I don't like myself. And I was trying to listen, and listen as a physician, because I could relate to that. I have suits in every size.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to understand what was going on, clinically with this woman. And that was the journey for the last 7 years. I had to go in, do the science, you know, understand what was going on clinically with this woman, go inside the food industry. You know, the Washington Post outed me. I was, you know, at one point I was dumpster diving to understand what was in our restaurant food. But we now know that it's not this woman's fault. We know the brains of millions of Americans are being excessively activated. Let me give you three characteristics. Okay? And when I raise these, you know, some people listen and say they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But for millions, they say, you're describing me. In fact, I gave the book to my family's doctor, and he said, for the first time, you're explaining me. You described me. I now know why I reach for that donut.
Mm-hmm.
So, let me give you the characteristics. Hard time resisting your favorite foods. A loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods. A lack of satiation. A lack of feeling full. A hard time stopping. Three, a preoccupation. A thinking about foods between meals, and sometimes when you're eating, just thinking about what you're going to be eating next. Those three characteristics, loss of control, lack of satiation, or preoccupation, thinking about foods between meals. Those three characteristics, in fact, we found that 50% of obese individuals, 30% of overweight individuals, 20% of healthy weight individuals, you know, self-report very high on those three scales. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but if you extrapolate, and there's risks of extrapolation, that's some 70 million people
mm-hmm.
who have that conditioned hypereating, we call it, because it's conditioned and driven. And what's most fascinating is when we scan the brains of those individuals, and we do it in two phases. You know, first, just the anticipation of each food. We don't even give them the food, but just the sight, the smell. Right? And we see that their brain activation is excessively activated compared to people who don't have this conditioned hypereating. But what's most fascinating is when they start to eat, the brain remains activated and stays activated until all the food is gone. So it's not a question, right, of willpower. It's not a question, you know, of the food industry just giving consumers what we want. We now know that what's going on is the brains of millions of Americans are being excessively activated.
It is interesting that you've put a name on a concept that I have thought about for a long time, obviously never crystallized it the way that you did in this book, but the idea that the companies, the food industry has made eating entertaining and made it an event instead of just a way to obtain nutrients.
What the business plans of the major American food companies have been is to take fat, sugar, and salt, put it on every corner, make it socially acceptable to eat and at any time, to make food, you know, entertainment, doing it with your friend. Walk into the food court in Union Station in D.C. You know, watch people. It's like a food carnival,
mm-hmm.
right? And what's happened is we've taken fat, sugar, and salt. We've taken down all the barriers because we can eat anytime. When I was growing up, You know, we ate at meals. There was structure to our eating. Sure, my grandmother used fat, sugar, and salt. She used it, you know, in desserts. I had it occasionally. What have we done? We're now eating fat, sugar, and salt throughout the day, right? The French, you know, up until recently, you know, they've always eaten highly palatable foods, but they didn't get fat. Why not? Because they ate within structure.
Mm-hmm.
It's true of the Canadians too. They would never snack. It was not socially acceptable to do that, right? What have we done? Now, any meeting, any time of day, you can be eating. And so we've taken down the barriers. We've broken down the barriers. And that fat, sugar, and salt, understand the cycle of consumption, right? You get cued. You get triggered. It could be the sight, the smell, the location, the time of day. I'd land in San Francisco Airport, and as soon as the plane hits the runway, I start thinking about these Chinese dumplings. Past experience, past learning, it cues you, it activates your brain. You have thoughts of wanting. There's arousal. It focuses your attention. It occupies your working memory. You eat to be able to release that tension, and then next time you cue, you do it again and again, and every time you do it, you only strengthen the neural circuitry. And the behavior is not just becoming conditioned. It's becoming conditioned and driven. Try to interrupt that circuitry once your brain is activated. You know, that thoughts of wanting, you know, boy, that would, you know, that inner dialogue, boy, that would taste good. No, I shouldn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I really would like that. No, not now. What happens when you start thinking like that? That only creates, you know, thoughts of wanting, obsessions, and that's the stuff of obsessions and cravings.
Dr. David Kessler is the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, and he's the author of a book that I commend to anybody who wants to understand the brain and its connection to food, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Now, you have a unique perspective on this because as the former head of the FDA, you have a tremendous understanding that the average doctor who looks into this wouldn't, about how policy impacts this. And now we're at this intersection of healthcare reform, and of course, one of the things that people are talking about is the overall condition of the American population, which is what you deal with in this book, and some of the problems that are becoming more and more common in Americans. Obesity, obviously, diabetes, some other health issues, and how the prevalence of these problems is driving the healthcare discussion because of the tremendous cost that's associated with them. As you think about some of the things that you write about in this book, and as you mentioned, the overuse of sugar, fat, and salt, all three drivers in obesity, high blood pressure, and a number of other problems, what do you see as potentially the role for maybe your former agency, for other federal agencies, in trying to maybe regulate, make recommendations to the food industry? What's the right balance between the players that are involved in this, do you think?
A very important question. You know, I wrote the book primarily to help people and people who have a hard time controlling their eating. But once you recognize, right, that the brains of millions of Americans are being excessively activated, that our behavior is becoming conditioned and driven, and conditioned and driven for a lifetime, and it's not just adults, it's kids, of course that has major policy implications. Does the food industry need to change? Absolutely. For the government, I mean, once you know the behavior is becoming conditioned and driven by fat, sugar, and salt, and it's kids whose behavior is becoming conditioned and driven, that has implications for the school lunch program, for what's in vending machines at schools, for what we subsidize in our farm subsidies, greater disclosure, I mean, on restaurant labeling, and certainly greater education. So there are major policy implications.
I have been surprised for years about something that kind of has come to a head here in Montgomery County, Maryland, the school district I live in, where there was a big fight for a period of time over whether soda machines should be taken out of high schools because Coke and Pepsi were paying subsidies to these individual schools, and the principals were able to negotiate deals, and the principals were saying, this is revenue that I really need because I don't have I'm not getting enough from the school district to be able to do the things that I need to do, and so this is a way of helping. I found it amazing that you could buy a Coke, which I don't know of any nutritional value whatsoever. It's a terrific product, and I've been known to drink a few myself, but I imagine there's questionable nutritional value for somebody that's in high school to be able to get one on premises, because it seems to me that constitutes an endorsement of the product. We think this is okay for you to consume.
Yeah, the Montgomery County schools, you know, both my kids went to the Montgomery County schools when we lived in D.C., and I think a lot of them. But I will tell you, the fact is, once you realize that fat, sugar, and salt, right, I mean, conditions the behavior and lays down the neural circuitry. You know, parents work so hard at home, you know, to make sure that, you know, the kids are safe, they eat right. Then you send them to school, and they get exposed to, you know, food that is just loaded and layered with fat, sugar, and salt. I mean, what is carbonated beverage? You know, it's sugar water, you know, with the carbonation, that tingling, but it's sugar water. Food, and there is no nutritional value.
Food coloring and caffeine are the only other things I can think of that are in there.
Right. So, but it's sugar is the main driver.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And once you get, you know, into that cycle, right, it's so hard to change that behavior. That neural circuitry lasts for a lifetime, and certainly has implications. I mean, the vending machines, right? Why expose kids to fat food that is just loaded and layered? I mean, it's so key to get kids involved in understanding their nutrition and trying to develop the skills and their curiosity so that they'll be able to protect themselves for a lifetime, because they're going to be constantly bombarded with the food industry with these cues. And the only way to do that is to make them, you know, to educate them on what's going on with them. They have to protect themselves from becoming manipulated and their brains from being hijacked, literally.
Dr. Kessler, I want to continue this conversation. Got to take a commercial break, so I'll ask you to stand by, and we will return in just a moment to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Dr. David Kessler. He is the former head of the Food and Drug Administration and author of the new book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. We'll continue our conversation about the policy ramifications of what he found in this book when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Earlier on Agency of the Month, sponsored by Pitney Bowes Government Solutions.
Homeland Security Inspector General Richard Skinner.
Independence is absolutely paramount to our mission. If we lose our independence, then we lose our objectivity, then we lose our credibility. So it's absolutely essential that we maintain our independence. Now, we have internal control programs to ensure that independence and make sure that it is working.
I'm Ruben Gomez.
DocuMagnificent. You heard me, DocuMagnificent. You're faced with compliance issues and budget pressure. You need to quickly process, archive, and access all of your key records for flexible, creative solutions backed by an 89-year history. Trust Pitney Bowes Government Solutions to get the job done right the first time, which is nothing short of DocuMagnificent. To learn more, visit online at pbgs.com/radio. That's pbgs.com/radio today.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
A state-run newspaper says that a Chinese submarine's reported collision last week with an underwater sonar apparatus towed by a U.S. destroyer in the South China Sea was likely an accident. The official China Daily cited Chinese military experts as saying the submarine's collision with the sonar array connected to the USS John McCain probably occurred due to a misjudgment of distance. No word on damage to the sonar array. I'm J.J. Green.
There's a lot of talk about thinking outside the box. But what about thinking inside the box? Airink is a company that looks at every angle when solving problems. In fact, Airink recently helped convert regular cargo containers into sophisticated air traffic and communications control facilities for use abroad, combining the shipping box and actual equipment into one turnkey system. Imagine that. Log on to www.arinc.com to learn more.
Take the average person out there. If I told you that you could save 15% or more on car insurance simply by switching to GEICO, you'd be pretty happy about that now, wouldn't you? You'd maybe invite me to tea or something. Well, if you're an employee of the federal government, we'd be drinking lots of tea. Because you can also get special discounts from GEICO over and above their already low rates. But it's not just about saving money. 97% of customers say they're satisfied with GEICO's service. In and of itself, that's a great reason federal employees have been choosing GEICO for over 70 years. And it's why so many federal employees continue to choose GEICO year after year. Gee, imagine if they all got together. Suppose we'd have enough tea to go around.
Well said, my little green friend. This is Mike Causey. If you're a federal employee, this is a great time to find out more about special GEICO discounts that may apply to you. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or visit geico.com and see how much you could save.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. David Kessler, who is author of the new book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Dr. Kessler, when someone chooses to overeat or not to overeat, it's really not anybody else's business. When someone does so because of issues that you talk about in this book, and when the general citizenry is forced to pay through taxes or whatever, higher insurance premiums, however it may be, for health care that's necessary because not of decisions that individuals have made, but because of business plans of food industry people, becomes a whole different issue. And as we talked about in the first segment of this interview, policy becomes much more important and much more relevant. And that seems to be where we find ourselves as Congress is, the members of the Senate, in fact, today are debating a health care plan and marking up a bill. Where should we be turning for answers / solutions / regulation? Is this an FDA issue? Is this an HHS issue? Or should we be looking to the members of the food industry to be policing themselves and say, you know what, we don't want to be bad citizens anymore. That's my term. And cause these problems, we want to put a product out there that is going to be better for people.
Well, you hit on a number of key points. I mean, once we have the science, I mean, now that we have it, right, that tells us that the behavior of millions of Americans is conditioned and driven. Right? I mean, that their brains are literally being excessively activated by these food cues. And that makes it so hard. I mean, you have to, and it's very key. You know, people just look at it and say, well, it's your choice to be fat. Well, I'm not sure I buy that, right? I mean, because once you understand that the behavior becomes, you know, conditioned and driven and the brain is excessively activated, right? I mean, that driven behavior, that motivational circuits, I mean, it's very hard to overpower. But just because your brain is hijacked, doesn't mean you don't have certain responsibility to try to fight back and take control. But we've never given people the tools. You talk about healthcare reform. 10 years ago, there were 4 cases per 1,000 of type 2 diabetes in the United States. What's the, you know, type 2 diabetes, I could just as well write obesity on the medical chart.
Mm-hmm.
Today, from those 4 cases per 1,000 a decade ago, it's become 9 cases per 1,000. What did we spend as a country on drugs for diabetes? In the year 2000, we spent $7 billion. Today, we're spending $13 billion. We all want greater health coverage, right? Universal coverage. We're all in favor of, you know, expanding that. How are we going to be able to afford it with that kind of increase in the real morbidity and mortality? But most important, you know, people don't want to be overeating. They don't want to be fat. But we've never explained to them what's going on.
I don't think I've ever met anybody who says, I really enjoy being overweight. You're right about that. Where do you see this going? Where do you see, as pertains the food industry? This is really, I mean, some of the things that you outline in your book, the behavior of some of the companies is not that much different as far as the the goals and the reasons behind the companies doing what they're doing not that much different than what you found out in the 1990s about the tobacco industry.
Certainly, you know, the tobacco industry, you know, 40, 50 years ago, confronted with evidence that cigarettes cause cancer, what did? They created doubt. They deceived the American public. They denied the existence of a link. Right? You know, leave aside what the food industry, you know, has known. Right? They certainly understand the inputs. They understand that fat, sugar, and salt stimulate. They understand the outputs that people keep on coming back for more. They've maximized, they've optimized, you know, food so that it achieves, you know, that bliss point. They've constructed food, right, so it's constant stimulation. They've created, they've added the emotional gloss. Right? They make food into into entertainment, the constant advertisement. Watch an ad tonight on TV for food. It's never going to be about the nutritional value of the food. Maybe it's sometimes about the economic value. But most of the time, it's trying to add that emotional gloss. You'll love it. You'll want it. So how did we succeed in tobacco? What was the real success? I mean, next week, you know, the president will sign tobacco regulation. But what's been the success up to now, the last 30 years? You know, we had a product. It was reinforcing. But what did the industry do? It created imagery. The product was cool, mm-hmm. that people wanted it, yeah. that it was sexy, the cowboy, right? How did we change that? How did we succeed? We changed what scientists call the valence of the product. Tobacco used to be positively valent. You looked at it, you looked at that stimuli and said, I wanted it, that's going to make me feel better, that's going to make me look cool. What did we do over the last 30 years? We made that product negatively valent. Mm-hmm. People now look at that product for what it is, a deadly, addictive, disgusting product. So, what, you know, the tobacco is easy. Right? Tobacco is easy because you live without tobacco. Food is hard.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, you need food to live. But we have to change how we view food. Food is so highly processed, so optimized, so constructed. I mean, pick an appetizer, you know, in any of the restaurants, you know, in the D.C. metropolitan, you know, suburb area. You know, I mean, pick, you know, the common appetizer. Pick buffalo wings. What is it? The fatty part of the chicken, fried in the manufacturing plants usually, refried in the kitchens, again, loading 30-40% additional fat. That red sauce, what is it? Fat and, you know, sugar. What's that white sauce, that creamy stuff on the side? Fat, sugar, and salt. What are we eating? Fat on fat on fat on sugar on salt on fat on salt. That's what we're eating. I used to think I was eating for nutrition, to fill me up for satisfaction. The fact is we're now eating for stimulation. Fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt stimulate our intake, and we're eating it throughout the day, anytime. It's socially acceptable to do that. Until we change what we want as consumers, if you look at that huge plate of fries and say, that's my friend, that's going to make me feel better, I want that. There's little I can do to stand in the way. You got to change what you want. It's what psychologists call a critical perceptual shift.
Do you see a role for maybe HHS or FDA or some other federal entity, maybe one that doesn't even exist yet, in changing that valence, as you refer to it, on food the way that some of the agencies with tobacco situation?
Absolutely. Greater education, greater disclosure, change in food lunch, school lunch programs. What we subsidize is with tax dollars. I think there are major policy implications.